You are listening to Kilometre Zero by the Cycling Podcast, powered by Zwift, the fitness app where fun is fast.
Well, Rich, does that take you back to last year's Tour de France?
It does, Lionel, yes. What a day that was. Stage 19 of the Tour. Everything was up for grabs. Julian Alaphilippe was still in the yellow jersey. We didn't really know what was going to happen. And what we certainly didn't expect was for the weather to play such a role. Although, if you remember, the previous evening, we stayed in a chalet up the hill, and the weather really turned that night. It was torrential rain. It was pretty dramatic, but not as dramatic as what followed the next day. As I was descending the Col de l'Isère in a car just ahead of the race, sky turned black and hailstones began falling, the like of which I've never seen before.
Yeah, and that started a train of thought, because during last year's tour, we were asked a question by a listener about the Tour de France's impact on the environment, but also the environment's likely impact on the Tour de France. And, well, last summer, the Giro Rosa also had a stage cancelled, didn't it, because of or altered significantly because of freak weather. The stage in the Tour de France.
So the Giro d'Italia, we had a stage altered there. And then also at the Vuelta, the stage that finished Andorra, you know, an incredible hailstorm as well at the top of the mountain, which didn't stop the stage, but it had a real impact on the spectators who were there and the riders as well.
And there was that incredible hailstorm in the
Critérium du Dauphiné.
That's right, where riders were sheltering under whatever they could shelter under. I mean, you know, freak weather happens, but the incidents of freak weather are becoming more frequent. You may remember, Rich, a few years ago, I made an episode of Kilometre Zero about the Tour de France's efforts to become greener. We travel around France, we're driving around France, there's a whole convoy of vehicles driving around France, the publicity caravan, all of the team vehicles, the planes and the helicopters. The carbon footprint of the tour is significant. I went out that day and looked at how the green zones were working, and that's where the riders get an opportunity to throw away their bidons, their gel wrappers, knowing that a team of people will be sweeping up after them. And those zone déchets have expanded, and now there are 126 of them on the whole tour route. Roughly every 30 or 40 kilometres, there's an opportunity for the riders to throw away their waste. And yet we still see riders throwing their bottles away outside of those zones, and the fines for doing that have been increased by the UCI. So there is a greater awareness of the sport's impact on the environment and the carbon footprint of the tour and of all the races. And some initiatives, there are a lot more initiatives year by year. Things are happening to try to make the professional cycling greener. De Koenig Quickstep announced at the start of the year their desire to become carbon neutral. The Étoile de Bessèges stage race in the south of France wants to become carbon neutral by 2023. And we're seeing more hybrid vehicles in the convoy. This issue is, you know, it's a live issue. We saw at the start of the year, and what started my train of thought at the start of the year was the wildfires in Australia, which were affecting the racing in Australia, and impact on the air quality caused by those incredible fires, and the sense that there will be more freak weather events over the next 10, 15, 20 years. And so I started to look at this issue from two different directions: the sport's impact on the environment, but also the environment's likely impact on the sport, and asked the question whether the Tour de France is even sustainable as an event in the height of the French summer. Could it be that actually in 20, 30, 40 years' time, the Tour de France is held in September, not as a consequence of the coronavirus crisis, but as a consequence of the changing climate? And so this is a little look at an issue that I've been diving into this year. We'll do an episode on this later on in the season, but we just wanted to take the temperature of the climate change debate and listen to some of the experts talking about how the climate might impact on events like the Tour de France, and also get the thoughts of some of our audio diarists.
My name's Paul McAlevey. I work for the European Environment Agency, and we monitor and report on and assess the state of Europe's environment. I'm the head of the Coordination and Strategy Department in the European Environment Agency. I got in touch to suggest Friends of the Podcast special episode looking at the sustainability of professional cycling. I had been browsing around the website last summer, the website of the Tour, and they had been promising that they were about to organise a responsible Tour de France, and they said that they would promote cycling for the planet. So I was digging around a bit, just looking into whether that was something they could stand by or if it was just greenwashing. This was the summer as well where Greta Thunberg, Extinction Rebellion, the Green Wave and the European Parliament elections were all getting some headlines, and I thought it would be quite topical just to say, okay, if you scratch below the surface of those marketing claims, what is actually the reality of professional cycling, its impacts on the environment, and the impacts of the environment on professional cycling? My own view was slightly sceptical. I just looking at the types of things they were stating, there didn't seem to be much to back it up. Also, I had been interested by listening to the podcast over recent years. You'd been calling out some of the environmental issues that had been arising. I remember when the Tour first went up, and was it in the Planche de Belfier? I may have got that wrong, but it was in one of the nature protection zones that was being opened up for the first time. That had provoked a bit of a debate. You'd spoken about the waste that's associated and the really bad image of seeing cyclists just tossing away gel wrappers and stuff by the side of the road. And my curiosity had been piqued a little bit by your controversial podcast in which you'd done an ethical ranking of teams. My first impressions were that maybe ASO and the UCI were maybe dabbling in a little bit of greenwashing.
My name is Benjamin Sanderson. I'm a climate scientist currently working at CERFAX, which is a research institution in France. My day job is running simulations of future climate with large computational models on supercomputers. I follow professional cycling for interest, and I'm a relatively keen amateur cyclist. So cycling has been close to my heart for a long time. The basics of the effect of greenhouse gases on climate are very well understood. Humans and society since the Industrial Revolution, have been pumping CO2 into the air. This has an effect on the balance of radiation coming into and out of the climate. And this has been going on for sufficiently long now that we're beginning to see really significant and evident changes in our climate. Clearly, on a global average sense, this is a warming trend. But regionally, it also changes precipitation. It changes the way that ecosystems respond. It changes how the water cycle works, how glaciers melt, and we're beginning to see these effects in the world around us.
Dr. Roger Dargaville, senior lecturer in renewable energy at Monash University in Australia. So at the moment, I work in integration of renewable energy systems, so trying to understand what the least cost combination of wind, solar, hydropower, pumped hydro, concentrating solar power, nuclear power, and all the conventionals as well, to try and work out what the least cost system to meet climate commitments could look like in the future. The bushfires have really been off the scale. Australia's always had bushfires. We've always had really quite serious bushfires. But one of the ways you can put it in context is by realising that the really bad fire weather we've had in the past are typically named after days. So we've got Black Saturday, Ash Wednesday, Black Friday. But we've had like 2 months of continuous serious bushfires. So it's not a single day, but just weeks and weeks of really extraordinary severe weather leading to severe bushfires. So it's Now, 2019 was by far the hottest year in Australia. We had more days averaged over the continent above 39 degrees than we've had in the entire history of the climate records that we've got for the continent. So it was just extraordinarily hot and dry. And then a couple of weeks later, we get hit with incredible rainfall as well. So it's a real season of extremes.
So I'm Dr. Kate Willett. I work at the Met Office in the UK. I'm a climate scientist, and I specialise on historical climate change. So I look at the observations of temperature and humidity and look at what's happening year on year and try and put that into context of the sort of historical record. And I do a lot on communication of climate change as well. Bike racing is hugely intense in terms of your physical exertion. And imagine keeping your body at safe temperatures is pretty critical. But if you add humidity into the mix, then it makes it really hard for your body to stay cool. It makes it really hard for you to evaporate sweat away. So I think humidity is quite an important factor in terms of climate change. It's not just the temperature, and it's the humidity that makes it quite difficult for the human body.
Well, climate science, climate policy always works with different scenarios, and you can look at the most optimistic scenario where emissions will decline and you move towards neutrality, or you can look at the business as usual scenario if we just go on for the next couple of decades like we have done globally for the previous decades, or there's some more worst case scenarios. The business as usual scenario, without thrown in too many numbers, the temperature is increasing at around about 0.2 degrees centigrade per decade at the moment. That's a business as usual scenario, which would mean that by the time you get to 2060, the average temperature would be about 2 degrees centigrade higher pre-industrial levels, so higher than it was around about 1750. That has really serious impacts, and that's on a business as usual scenario. If global emissions keep rising, you're in worst case scenarios. And there, if you're looking at a 2.5, even a 3 degree increase, the impacts are even greater.
I think now the last 5 years have been, from a climatic point of view, have been the point at which you no longer need, you know, a degree in statistics to be able to tell that things are changing. Somebody who's just mildly observant about the climate system, and about the weather, about, you know, the way that glaciers look, can now really tell that what the world that we're seeing now, the extremes that we're seeing now, are different to what we grew up with in the 20th century. And so we now find ourselves fairly, as a society, for the first time in this position where kind of everybody, to some degree, is increasingly aware that there's a problem.
Well, they're like our modern-day gladiators, aren't they? We do expect our professional sports people to endure incredible conditions. Even when the weather's nice, we expect them to almost kill themselves for our viewing pleasure. But yeah, when the weather is appallingly difficult and they're expected to go on, it's dangerous for their health. And but they don't always go on. It sometimes matches are cancelled or postponed, stages are shortened, and sometimes players will retire. They do quit. They don't always keep on going to the bitter end.
In terms of heat stress, yeah, July is a notoriously hot month, and I can see a time where that actually could be very problematic. I mean, obviously, professional athletes are incredibly capable of dealing with these extremes, but there does come a time where you physically cannot keep your body cool. So there's something called the wet bulb temperature, and generally we don't tend to see wet bulb temperatures much above 31 degrees. That's a pretty extreme wet bulb temperature. And once you're getting close to 35 degrees, that's generally your skin temperature, then it becomes pretty impossible for you to evaporate any sweat away. So as we get closer to those sort of the 30 degrees and above 30 degrees in the wet bulb temperature, that makes it really quite dangerous to be physically active. So I can't give you a precise date on when that sort of thing might occur, but we know that heat waves are becoming more frequent and they're becoming more intense. And that's, we're already seeing that. It's the way that we measure humidity is usually done through measuring the air temperature and then measuring this wet bulb temperature. So you have another thermometer and it's coated in a bit of material that dips into water. So the thermometer is wet. And depending on the humidity of the air, you get evaporation taking place. And so that thermometer will read slightly cooler than the normal air temperature thermometer. And so depending on the difference of those two thermometers, you get the humidity measure. But it's that wet bulb temperature that's really, that really tells you about the humidity. And so if the wet bulb temperature is equal to the dry bulb temperature, then it means you've got 100% relative humidity. And it's really quite hard to, it's really going to be very difficult to evaporate sweat away.
I won't pretend to understand the economics of how big cycle races, make ends meet. But certainly in terms of, take for example the size of the publicity caravan and the number of vehicles involved advertising the same product. One could imagine a way of structuring that which could slash the emissions considerably. This is a huge number of vehicles who do multiple times the length of the entire Tour de France, for example.
I understand why. In order to move into new markets, some of the Grand Tours want to go to new countries. But then, in the case of the Giro, if you have three stages, in Israel, and then suddenly need to fly the entire race back to start in Sicily or wherever it is the following day, I mean, that's just okay from a marketing point of view. It might make sense, but that would be an easy win, surely.
Brutally, I don't think that emissions are going to really start coming down unless there is a big enough price on carbon that it makes it economically sound to make low carbon decisions. And so, broadly, until the day comes that there are policies in place to make the plane more expensive than the train, we're not going to solve this.
Every part of society has carbon emissions associated with it. Like nothing really happens without some kind of form of energy or being involved. And so it means that every part of our lives really has to contribute to reducing emissions. And so bike racing is, we'll have to play its part. Obviously, COVID is at the front of everyone's minds right now, and it's been hugely difficult, and I think it will continue to be hugely difficult for people. But it's also given people a taste of a different type of lifestyle, and one that is maybe a bit more conducive with lower emissions. So I think it has changed our focus in the short term, but I think it's perhaps given us a few thoughts about how we might tackle climate change. And I think now there is a growing movement to say, look, we need to kind of keep on the ball with climate change. We haven't got much time if we want to stay below this 1.5 degrees that's the Paris Agreement. So really time is ticking, and so we haven't got much time to really get our heads around reducing emissions.
You are listening to Kilometre Zero by the Cycling Podcast, powered by Zwift, the fitness app that turns indoor riding into a game. Explore endless roads, race riders from all over the world, and boost your fitness with monthly training plans and structured workouts. Join the world's training playground where fun is fast. Go to Zwift.com and start your free trial.
I'm Mitch Docker, pro cyclist for EF Education First, pro cycling team. Zwift plays two roles for me in my training. It is the top end stuff, the last effort I need to do before a grand tour. And my coach puts me on Zwift to get the finer details right before I hit a grand tour. It's like, okay, we've got 10 days of Zwift. Let's get that finer detail in. We combine it with the road riding. We chuck a Zwift on in the evening. And that's that little extra special tip that we have before we hit a grand tour. And then secondly, what I've now found out is lockdown. Time at home. It keeps me at home. I'm able to pump out one or two sessions a day. When I'm at home, I'm there with the family and I can get my work done quickly, easily, and I'm still at home. So it's a double-edged sword for me. It's hardcore or it's enjoyable when I'm at home. Once the weather gets bad, you can stay inside and you can get the quality done and it's enjoyable. You can chat with your mate on the phone or you can see him there and chat on the screen and you can ride in a bunch. You've got people to ride with. There's no longer those days of sitting in a dark room, punching away on an ergo, watching your Garmin, watching the seconds tick by. That's what I like about it, that instead of trying to go out and fight the rain, fight the weather, I can stay inside, an hour is enough, an hour and a half if you want, 2 hours if you're really good, and that is going to be enough to do for me in the middle of the winter, in the bad weather, to get the training done.
Tom Southam, EF Pro Cycling.
I think that climate change is going to impact racing and is impacting racing more and more. Last year, I had a period where, I mean, I spent half the year in Australia, the off-season, and then the racing season in Europe, and I had a period where I left Australia to go to a training camp in California with the team. And basically, when I left Australia, it was on fire, and I went to California, and California was on fire. We had to change all of our training routes, and most of the roads were affected where we were having our training camp. We didn't know whether we were going to have to reposition it somewhere else or not. When we did want to go to San Francisco, I think San Francisco was also on fire. And then I went back to Australia, and races were impacted by, and training camps were impacted by the quality of the air, from the smoke, from the fires. Off the back of the tour the year before, which was hit by an unseasonal storm. I feel like cycling, as much as everything else, is being impacted, and cycling, you know, pro cycling, as much as everything else, is having its part to play in the reason that that's happening. I think that people are becoming more aware inside the sport. I feel like as awareness grows, things will change. I think there is obviously quite a lot of low-hanging fruit with the size of our carbon footprint. And the sooner that that starts to get addressed, the better it's going to be for everyone. But, you know, not just in pro cycling, but across the board.
Nikias Arndt, Team Sunweb.
It was a warm week the last few days. But luckily, it was no extreme weather. It is playing more and more a role, these extreme weathers. On the one hand, you have these really hot temperatures. And in my opinion, everything what goes above body temperature is really hard for the body. Also, always a little bit of risk. It's basically like fever. So if you go above body temperature and your body is overheating, then yeah, it's kind of fever. And I think, yeah, that is really not good for our bodies. At the end, if everyone does a little bit, we help already a lot. And that is, for example, in racing, we have a lot of waste. We have the paper from the bars, we have bottles. And if we just use the waste zones, I mean, here in the Tour de France, we have 6 waste zones per day. And if we throw it out there, yeah, then there are people who collect it straight away, and we don't throw any garbage into the environment. I think that is, for example, a small step where we can help the environment. And the same as our team is part of Trees for All. So yeah, basically for all flights which we are taking, or for all vehicles we are driving through the whole year, we are compensating it a little bit. And I think it's a really nice effort from the team, which they do extra to also have a little bit better, let's say, green footprint. We are doing a little bit, and I think if everyone helps there a little bit, we can help the environment, and can maybe also prevent that we have these extreme days too often in the future.
Gunnar Swift, Arkea Samsic.
There is a massive carbon footprint. Obviously, you think about the Grand Tour. There's 8 riders. There's 30 staff per team. I think every team's got a bus, a mechanics truck, a food truck, Swanee cars. There's probably about, you know, 16, 17 vehicles or so per team. You know, we're transferring before and after every stage. Everyone's flew in or something like that. So the travel logistics is absolutely huge. So yeah, I think going into the future, it's probably important, you know, for the teams to lower in their carbon footprint and the impact on the environment that they have. I haven't got the solutions for that, but I think it is definitely something that needs to be considered going into the future.
Pavel Sivakov, Ineos Grenadier.
I'm quite conscious, you know, all the vehicles, all the vehicles we have, all of the resources are behind one race, especially a race like the Tour. If you start thinking about it, of course, it's not, even though we're racing on bikes, it's not the best for the environment, really. It's even pretty bad, I would say.
Jens Kukeler, EF Pro Cycling.
Since I started as a professional cyclist, I've always had years where the weather was really extreme some days, going from snow and really cold temperatures, hailstorms, to really warm temperatures. Every year I've had a couple of extreme weather days on the bike. I maybe think, I don't really know if it's, I haven't really noticed a big change in the environment, and maybe one professional career isn't long enough to really see the change. One thing I really like, and you see it more and more now in the races, is that there's a lot more attention going to the rubbish we have. The organizers are trying to really be aware of the environment.
Ryan Gibbons, NTT Pro Cycling.
It's come a long way. I think 10 years ago, you know, you'd often see riders just tossing bars and gels and buttons everywhere. You know, on TV, you probably see riders doing this a lot, and you think, you know, that's littering. But when it comes to bittens, you know, the spectators and the fans on the side of the road, for them, that's gold. So whenever you see a rider toss a bottle, don't think it's just going to stay there and you know, it's going to be picked up pretty much before it's stopped moving, and, you know, taken as a souvenir. And in races, you know, you also have what's called green zones, which is where you can drop your litter. And I'd like to say that, in my opinion, I think 90% of the peloton respect that, and, you know, have an energy bar and will put the paper back in their pocket or behind their saddle, and then when they enter the zone, they'll drop it. And if not, you know, it's maybe in a crunch point of the race where they just have a gel and they toss it. But generally, the race organizers do have a kind of a sweep vehicle that picks up everything and people monitoring that.
Simon Geschke, CCC team.
There are green zones in place, especially here. I think the Tour de France started with it. So you have certain zones where you can throw away your papers. The riders, really, they take care about it. As soon as the peloton goes through these zones, you see all the riders lifting their jerseys a little bit, and everything falls out. So, yeah, every rider actually really plays an important role. But when you think about it, that pro cycling is also a way to inspire people or motivate people to commute more on their bikes, which I hope it does, of course. There is a certain balance, I think.
Hi, my name's Lizzie Banks, and I'm a professional cyclist with a Keep Paul car.
Well, we only have one Grand Tour in the women's peloton, and it's usually the Giro Rosa in July. This year it's in September, and we're actually in central and southern Italy, and it's still, you know, 34, 35 degrees today. But last year, the first stage of the Giro Rosa was 39 degrees, but that is what Italy's like in the summer. Obviously, if it ends up getting much hotter, then it gets to a point where it's just unbearable. And, you know, we rode Strade Bianche on the 1st of August, and there just happened to be a heat wave, and it was 43 degrees when we were going up the gravel sector, and it really had a big impact on the race, because so many riders just, you know, had to climb off their bikes because of the heat. One of the things that I really don't like about this sport is some of the wastefulness. I mean, we drive around all over the place, and sometimes, you know, the UCI is to blame. We have this situation at the beginning of our traditional calendar where we have Trofeo Binda in Italy, in the north of Italy. Then we go back up to the north of the Netherlands for Drenthe, and then we come back down to Italy for Strada. I mean, not only would it make everybody's lives easier, but think of the thousands of miles and kilometres saved in driving as well. So, I mean, yeah, it's a wasteful sport. One of the things I hate most is how much water, how much plastic bottled water we drink, because I don't know, it's one of those things that, is it really necessary? I don't know. But then if you ended up getting sick from water and not being able to race, that's just such a stupid reason. So we use a lot of plastic in the cycling team, and I really, really don't like that impact. It also really gets my goat when people throw bottles in fields, and I don't see why it's necessary. You can always wait to throw something to a spectator or a marshal. And I was applauded after Grand Prix Plouay because there's a video where I had my bidon in my cage, and I waited to throw it until I saw a spectator. And there weren't many spectators on the course because of the COVID guidelines. But that shouldn't be the world that we're living in, that people are applauded for not littering. I mean, it's really not difficult to put a gel wrapper back in your pocket. And of course, there are always going to be moments where it's hectic, or it happened to me today, actually. I took something out of my pocket and a gel was stuck to the thing, and then I dropped the gel on the floor. So obviously there are going to be accidents, and that's unavoidable. And you know, when you're traveling at 50 kilometers an hour, you can't stop and pick it up. But it's pretty easy to not throw your bottle into a field, and it's just so unnecessary. It really, really, really irritates me.